So I want to start with a story about Tomoko, if I could. I visited her shortly after she came under hospice care, and then I visited her again about a week before she died. And what I is a hospice, longtime hospice caregiver. It was rare to find someone who was that vibrant and interested in investigating their own dying process. Even though the last time I saw her, she was weakening considerably just from the course of her illness, she still had that that fervency to know and to discover. And so she would ask me, she would say, well, so what do you know? What's it like to die? And which, believe it or not, I've been asked many, many times. It always throws me for a loop. And I said, I have no idea. And I said, what do you think it's like? And she said she didn't know either. And so I said, well, let's be quiet together and just and see what comes up. And we did. We got still and quiet. And I said, maybe this is as close as we'll ever come to the answer. And there was a meeting there that is rare. And that acknowledgement, you know, of two people in the art of discovery, right? Because I was trying to figure it out too. I was interested too. And a true meeting in there, that true meeting place, where you realize that the silence that we all share is really the basis of our humanity, the basis of our sense of connection and heart. And I just wanted to stay there with her as long as she was able to. And of course, then circumstances move as they will, and we separated. But I knew that there was a meeting. And I don't think we should ever trivialize those true and genuine moments of meeting. I often thought of the Twin Towers as they were being disintegrated by those airplanes, that sometimes people would jump out of the windows of the towers holding hands, you know. And to me, the real blessing was that they had somebody to hand to hold. You know, that was death in companionship. And in some ways, tonight I hope to bring forth that as almost a definition of Sangha, of companionship in death. We have to understand what death is to approach the subject, but if we take the only definition that I know, which is a kind of absolute quiet, sort of the end of all of our words, we might have a sense of what that moment truly is. I was touched by, I was reading T.S. Eliot's Four Quartet, and he has a couplet there. He says, for last year's words belong to last year's language, and next year's words await another voice. And I, you know, as a New Year's celebration, as a New Year's transition, much of it goes towards celebration. But there's also a genuine opportunity for us to be quiet together, to acknowledge what has been and the tasks and duties and emotions that are left unfinished from the previous year. We can release that burden. And going into the next year, we really don't know. We may have it all planned out on our calendar. I hope not, but And our life can be very full, but it doesn't in any way take away from the opportunity to really feel the quiet of the passing of one and the beginning of another. As the grounds of our earth are met with the winter coldness and the furrowed earth lives unplowed, there can be an opportunity for us to be unplowed as well, for us to just sense that which has not yet begun and that which is over. Unfortunately, because we're very unaccustomed to that kind of self-reflection, we celebrate with fireworks the passing of a year and the beginning of another, when really what most of our hearts wish for is a moment of quietude, of genuine reflection. Is our life moving in the direction that we want it to? Have we lived our life in the past year as fully as we wished? And if not, what is it that we can do to move it and nudge it within that direction? Is this sufficient? Is the way my life is moving sufficient for my own ending? If I were to die this year, would I have done what I feel most called and pulled in my heart to do? And not letting anyone tell us what we should be doing, or for anyone to point out their desires or their yearnings for our journey, but to genuinely ask ourselves with intentionality about the journey we are already on and whether we have given it sufficient heart. Have we really shown up for this thing? You know, and would there be some regret if we were to maintain the level of true embrace of the Dharma and to lose our life this year? It's such a fragile existence. One Buddhist scholar said, what arrogance to think that there is going to be an in-breath after an out-breath. It's that fragile. And yet our celebration, the way we meet the occasions of deep reflection, the way we make noise instead of allowing ourselves to be governed by the quiet that we all seek, shows that many of us give little value to that pause, to a proper orientation and intentionality for ourselves. You begin to realize in the course of our Dharma practice that the Dharma only really has one direction. It's really only pointing in one way. It doesn't, the fingers don't cross here. It's really tugging sufficiently towards a greater quietude in us, a greater sense of ease, a greater sense of openness, a greater sense of appreciation and gratitude and communion and interconnection. And all of that requires resources, opportunities to take those pauses whenever they're offered to us and to reflect on the way our life is going and to readjust, to make those minor adjustments necessary in our life to really fully live it. How many times do we know what we should do and bypass that activity? We knew what we should have done. In fact, someone once said that Dharma practice is simply doing what you know you should do. So this sense of full embodiment, this sense of a full relationship with our life, and to bring that relationship into a full embodiment within the doings and activities that address the ongoing confusion of our life, that looks towards clarity instead of that confusion, that looks towards connection instead of that disconnect. Those are opportunities that we have moment after moment that don't require a monastic life in order to live. They just require an intentionality from us, a willingness to be quieter than noisy. And you begin to realize that there's very little healing. In fact, I can't even, when I was thinking about this earlier in the day, which is interesting because some construction workers are putting molding, new molding on our house, and everything, all the furniture is piled in the middle of all the rooms. And so I'm trying to reflect on quietude. And I thought, okay, so, you know, this is it. You know, I don't have another house that I can leave and venture seek out deeper quiet. This is it. Hammers and nail shooters. I don't know what they're and all of that. And, you know, I'm okay, so this is it. So where is the quiet here? Not the quiet externally, because the quiet externally isn't there. Where is the inward quiet? Where is my ability to meet this moment? And what it required from me is a yes. If I met the moment with a yes, there was quiet in that moment, you see? If I met it with a no, this, I have to get out of here, go to the library, I don't even know if it's open, all of the worry and all of that, then it would have been just a continued noisy existence. And even in with all that ruckus, and you think, okay, this is it. This is the moment, this is it. You know, there isn't another life to be lived here. Where is the life within the here that is to be lived? And there's the death, you see. That's the death. The noise keeps us very much alive, fictitiously. The assumptions of it all. Keeps us very entertained, because that's what we call aliveness at some one phase of our maturation. We call entertainment an intensity life. But at another phase of maturity, we don't seek that. We seek a very altered way of living that assures us of connecting with life, not trying to have life be lived for us. And to find our way into that doesn't require a special environment. I remember Ellen and I were taking, we signed up for a cruise on Lake Washington, Christmas cruise. It was costly, so I thought we'd really get something out of it. And it was like $50 off, and it was still costing us like $150 or $200 and a meal, you know, and all this stuff. And I had this idea that we would have a lovely 3 or 4 hours. It was a long cruise around Lake Washington. We would just sit, you know, and just be quiet and watch whatever it was that you watch, wherever the boat goes. Well, we got on the boat, and immediately I knew that this was going to be not what I expected. First of all, they cramped us in, so we were like sitting right next to, and the boat was just full. And the quote, delicious dinner they were going to serve turned out to be spaghetti and garlic bread. you know, when the boat took off, we knew it was too late to get off. And that's when the band started. And so, I mean, and then there was this kind of cramped dancing floor. And there was, because it was cold, it wasn't this Christmas, it was a few Christmases ago, it was cold, there was no way to get outside of that space of confusion and noise and, you know, alcohol, really, and just all of that. And so this was it. You know, for 4 hours, we jostled around. But that was the life. That was it, you see. And I know, it could have been a miserable 4 hours. I don't remember it being as miserable as I'm now stating it to be for the drama of it all. But, it's not something I would do again, that's for sure. But we just spent time speaking to one another, just connecting and looking out when we had the opportunity. And so I don't know. We can make this life workable in many different ways, but it takes an intention to do that. And the normal ways that society point and govern and suggest are the way we live. It just isn't conducive to a Dharma awakening. It's not conducive to awareness. It's not conducive to asking the questions that make life meaningful and purposeful. And so in this time of the New Year's, let us not forget how to ask those questions. Let us not forget that those questions exist. It's almost like two people who almost refuse to discuss what's really going on between them, because it would open up too much pain. So too, we refuse to ask questions that we really need to ask because we are sensing that those questions may expose us to our own pain. And yet, if you live in that relationship with that kind of resentment for very long, it either ends in divorce or it ends in a lot of fighting and discord. So too within us. We just keep divorcing ourselves further in the process, becoming more suppressive, suppressed, and resistant to the themes of our life, or more argumentative, or more noisy, which is a form of argument, you see. When we feel the noise, the quiet gaining ground, we get noisy. We argue against it. That's the way we do. We argue against it either in external noise or internal noise. Either one works sufficiently. I can talk myself into a very convincing role, to a very convincing sound of desperation. But we remember that there's a straight line here. There's a straight line that the Dharma only moves in one direction. And for us to ask, okay, is my life, is it at least within the vicinity? Is it moving in relationship to that one, single direction? And what one of the beauties you find when you're living with more quiet in your life is that that quietude dissolves. It dissolves pretension, doesn't it? It dissolves argument. It dissolves contrast and judgment. It dissolves virtually all of the ways that we try to keep life distant from us simply by being quiet. Simply by the willingness not to argue. And you can feel yourself coming into alignment with that straight line direction of Dharma. Simply by being quiet. Simply by being willing to let yourself dissolve. And that's why it feels so threatening to most of us. Is that we like the distinction of the noise we make. We like our voice being higher pitched and more argumentative than yours. We like the rub of contention because that gives us the definition of ourselves. And yet that definition, if quiet takes it away, how substantial is it? If it can be lost simply by being quiet, then how important is the distinction we make if it's so easily lost? So we're not so interested in what leaves us in quiet, it's what remains when we are quiet. That has something more fulfilling to say. That has something to say about death. The noise doesn't have anything to say about death. You aren't going to talk your way through your dying. Well, you may try, but there's going to be a point when you can't. But what else sustains itself through that? See, that's what we're looking for in the Dharma, is what is it that, what can I count on here? What can I have faith in? What will sustain itself beyond the frivolousness of it all, the superficiality of it all? Where can I land? Where can I base my existence upon, you see? Well, you base your existence upon what existence is based upon. Because if existence is based upon something, that something will last as long as it lasts. But existence itself is quiet. There's nothing there. Nothing that I can gather around and claim personal reference to. There is something there, but it's not personally owned. And that's why existence, when we are quiet, it brings us to existence. And guess what? Existence, it connects us with humanity. It connects us with all beings, not just humanity, but all beings, all sentient beings. That's what quiet does. That's the movement of quiet. That's the direction it takes. And therefore, if I'm willing to be quiet along with that dissolution, if I'm just go with it and see what's there. You know, you can always come out, believe me, just say your name and out you come. Just say I, and you're back in shape. Right? But if we're just quiet, without keep claiming our self-referencing, that quiet won't allow you to move with it. So what does that tell you about the nature of you and me if the quiet takes it away? Well, if it takes it away, let it go. What's there? What remains after that? What remains? You see, to take refuge in the Buddha is to take refuge in that quiet. We're going to be taking refuge tonight. I'm not asking you to become a Buddhist. I'm not asking you to take refuge in the Buddha as your savior at all. But I'm suggesting that there is a direction and intentionality that the refuge could take that's meaningful to each and every one of us in this room. If we frame it in a way that we see the commonality of the quiet we all share together. The true birthing of ourselves. This whole holiday has been filled with symbols of birth. What's the true birthing of ourselves, of our new self? What's the true birthing of our new self? And when we take that on with that intention, okay, I'm just going to be quiet. That's all. I'm just not going to say anything. And what I do say, I'm going to hold within quiet so it doesn't keep compelling me to towards greater and greater thinking. That's just going round and round. So I'm just going to hold whatever noise is there in quietude. Not to dispute it or try to suppress it, just hold it in quietude so that it can say whatever it wants to say and I'll just listen. The listening will be my response to the noise. And suddenly we begin to feel at home. That's what's so amazing, as we think the home is in the noise. And we keep trying to better the noise to find a better home, better thinking, better emotions, better moods. And as we are constantly trying to shore up the better that we believe the world can offer in terms of our thoughts and moods, there's a continual earthquake under our feet, taking it away, even as we try to substantiate it. Now, what sense does that make? It's like sandcastles. The tide is coming. Enjoy it while you got it, but it's going to last just as long as low tide. But it doesn't even last that long. It lasts as long as it's stated, as long as it's said. And then it isn't. And then it isn't. And so we keep bringing something else back that is. And that there it is, and now it's not. And now it is, and now it's not. And we've so trained ourselves to look to what is that we mix the contest. We mix the context of the quiet that holds it. Just like New Year's, fireworks, oh, beautiful. What's the context? What's the night sky? What's the context that holds it? Do we have any intention to know the context? Or just to be entertained, right? Nothing wrong with entertainment, but just low tide. That's all. It gets too disappointing. Your expectations are never met. There's momentary gratification, but nothing lasting. No real contentment, no ease. Because even if there is ease, we're wise enough to know it's not going to last very long, so there's a kind of built-in anxiety to the ease we do have. So we take refuge in the Buddha, and we land. And it seems preposterous or even contradictory to say that we land on nothing, but we do land on nothing. We land within nothing. We land within everything. Nothing, the nothing of wisdom is the everything of the heart. And so there's communion. We land at the Final Supper. Taking refuge in the Buddha. And with the greater sense of discernment than we've ever known possible through the veil of our thinking, suddenly there's clarity, there's understanding, there's seeing. Not fictitious. I'm not giving you some dharma. This is true. This is what it looks like. This is possible. Not hokey pokey. So what will we trust, you see? What will we trust? Will we trust the noise or will we trust the quiet? And that question is always before us. It's always before us. In argument, it's always before us. Because if you don't trust the quiet and do trust the noise, the argument will continue. Because you won't have won it. And you need to win it. In order for it to be resolved in your mind, there has to be a winner, and it has to be you. And if it doesn't, you don't win this time, by God, I'll get him the next time. And even if you do, you don't. And so there's a, I don't know, it's just having lived enough years to know this, that's all. I don't even know if it requires much soul searching. It just requires a cold slap of water to our face. Just remember that the quiet embraces humanity. We don't become lost in quiet. We become found. Everyone becomes found. Everything is discovered. The heart connects. Taking refuge in the Sangha. Taking refuge in unforced connection. That's how I defined it. In unforced connection. I love that. Because you come in willingly. You see, you just come in, you know, just... And yes, there, you know, I don't know anybody here. There's a lot of people. I don't know if this is the right... All of that. If you're willing to wade through all of that, you'll find a common core of unforced togetherness where silence is respected, not demanded, but respected. So that if you want to be quiet when we're meeting in groups or whatever the expression is for that evening, that's fine. And you'll find that individually, as those relationships nourish, you found somebody who you can be quiet with, who doesn't demand a display, a personal display. Like, you're not quite entertaining enough for me, so I think I'll move on. Do you ever feel that? Because what we're interested in when we do gather together is what's authentically here for us. What's authentically meaningful. What can be found or discovered together that may be too difficult alone. If I take you into a hospice interdisciplinary meeting where you have 15 people sitting around a table discussing one patient at the center of the discussion. And so you have the chaplain and the volunteer coordinator and the nurse and the chaplain and the social worker and all of that interdisciplinary court. And it was almost like a primal meeting of sort of Stone Age people. We knew there was something back there that we were talking about, and that was death. But we had gathered together to be able to share the spirit of communion and of life, even though we were talking about death. And this, if we turned around, would scare us, probably too much so to do individually. But together, around the whole table, we could talk about it very easily. And we could reassure each other that we were there to hold each other's hand as the building was demolished. And that's Sangha. And if you don't know that, where have you been? I take refuge in the Buddha. And I take refuge in the Sangha. Refuge from the storm. You mean I can actually be quiet with you? Nothing special, you see. No hyperbole here. You don't have to entertain me. Just together. Just the raw bones of togetherness. Doesn't even matter whether our personalities fit, really. Because at some level of maturity, that's just like vanilla cake or chocolate cake, you see. Like, what is this? What is it really? But we still have another refuge. We still take refuge yet again. We take refuge in the Dharma. Entering fully what is present, that's taking refuge in the Dharma. It's like jumping in. The moment is, that's all we need to know. There is no alternative to this moment. It's only our minds that tell us differently. And so to undertake the journey into the moment, the undefended fact of this moment, the undefended fact of this moment, is to take refuge in the Dharma. What is it like to want to know what the moment is more than what I am in the moment? Than what I am in the moment. Most of us want to know what I am in the moment. But if you carry the sense of you along with yourself in the moment, you're never going to know what the moment is. Just to trust it. Taking refuge. Why don't I push it a little bit? Why don't I force this issue forward? And I mean force, I don't mean effort. I mean just knowing that there's only one direction to this thing and be willing and having the courage to take that direction. Because as long as the details, the personality of the moment, you might say, what's coming in mentally, in the frame of reference of this moment, all of my thoughts, the reasons I want to stay out of it, the emotions that are stirred within this moment, all of that history and all of my opportunities going forward, all of that is so swirls in front of our eyes with such declarations of purpose. That something is missed terribly. And why it is that it's being missed is that we keep playing upon all of that commotion as being the substance of why it is it's important to live. All of it, all of the doubt and self-discouragement, all of that And at some time, at some point, there's a simple statement. I'm walking into this thing, and I'm not paying attention to that commotion. The commotion can swirl around me as it will. Can I listen through all of that to what's at the heart, the center? Can I let everything else dissolve? Because it's just swirling ideas and colorful trappings. It's just commotion and confusion. And I know that there's something very important packaged within all of that that holds it all, but can't be seen because the commotion keeps taking my attention away. And I enter. And I enter the Buddha. And I sit on his lap. And I enter the Sangha. As we die together. And I enter the Dharma because I'm tired of pretending that there's some other way to live. And I don't do this harshly. I do it with ease and intentionality. The effort no longer being the effort to overcome, but the effort to connect. That's the only effort that is needed, is the effort to connect. Not the effort to overcome. If I keep the effort aligned with connection, then I keep myself moving towards deeper sense of quietude. If I move towards overcoming the obstacles in front of me, I am in more tension and more angst because how I have framed the problem. But simplicity threatens our culture. Quiet threatens our culture. And so you'll never get validation from the culture through this undertaking. But you will through your own heart and through the hearts of similar and like-minded people called the Sangha. That's where you'll find the validation needed. And may it be so for all of us. Thank you.